One thing that one gift, I guess, of disability, especially a very, very visible one, like it cannot mask. Like some people talk about the it's exhausting to mask, and I can't even, I mean, I can imagine, but I can't relate to that because that is like the opposite of how my life has unfolded. So at a certain point, you can continue to be upset by it, or you can just say, I can't possibly use my brain energy on being upset with how people perceive me. And it was around junior high when I kind of finally was like, you know, like I don't care enough to care about this, you know? I mean, it's not fun. Like sometimes little kids will cry when they see you, or people will ask, I mean, things that you like I could talk about more, but I don't, because it's obviously like if we had more education about disability and like more inclusion, that wouldn't happen. It's novelty, that's what it is. And it's usually not malicious. Once in a great while you run into someone where you're like, are they trying to be a jerk? But like honestly, even the weirdest comments usually come out of like they don't know what to say and they're trying to connect, or they're trying to assure themselves of something, or like it's almost never about me.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman, which I hope inspires you through the personal stories of a fascinating diversity of musical guests. Gaylin Lee is a violinist, singer-songwriter, disability rights advocate, author, and public speaker. Born with osteogenesis imperfecta, commonly known as brittle bone disease, Gaylin began her musical journey with the support of a childhood music teacher and her musical family. You'll hear about how her big break happened when she won NPR Music's Tiny Desk Contest in 2016, which led to a fascinating creative life, which in the last few years has included international touring and scoring Macbeth on Broadway, starring Daniel Craig and Ruth Negga. Gaylin is really open to trying new things, and this really came through as she talked to me about how she'll never have enough time to explore all her curiosities, reflections on her first compositions and songs, how she collaborated with mentors Alan Sparhawk and Charlie Parr, and how she created a new musical fable for the stage called Invisible Fences with disabled storyteller Kevin Kling. You'll be hearing clips from some of Gaylin's albums during the podcast, and her Bandcamp is linked in the show notes for you. We begin with a look at her upcoming memoir, It Wasn't Meant to Be Perfect, a warm, funny, and deeply felt exploration of disability, music, and the messy creativity of an artist's life. I plan to welcome Gaylin back for a future episode focused on that work. You can find the pre-order link in the show notes. It will be published by Algonquin Press in April 2026. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast on many podcast platforms, and I've also linked the transcript. It's a joy to bring these inspiring episodes to you every week, and I do all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. Have a look at the show notes of this episode, where you'll find all the links, including different ways to support this podcast. Hey, Gaylin, so nice to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I know you've been really busy editing your upcoming memoir. It's going to be published this coming spring.
Yeah, on April 14th. It's called It Wasn't Meant to Be Perfect, and it'll be out on Algonquin Press, so it's like coming up. It seems like far away still, kind of, but we're starting to really get into planning the release, so it's really exciting time, actually.
It really is, and this is a sort of a long-term project. You've been working on it for a while.
Yes, in 2021, I started working with a book coach to like make a book proposal, because that's what you need for nonfiction books. You don't like finish the book first, you send it out as a proposal. That took about a year. I mean, it was like such a bigger process than I imagined. You have to have a couple sample chapters, and I ended up having to rewrite those because they weren't strong enough, and like just kind of all this stuff took forever. And then I got it in a little bit after Macbeth, to be honest, and then it took 15 months to write. I mean, I'm not the fastest probably, but also it was a big project. And then I have been editing it since the end of December 2024. So like the last 9 months has been editing. So it's just it's cool, but it is a lot bigger than I thought. And you kind of think, oh, you know, I've done lots of writing, and like, oh, this proposal even the proposal, what how it started and what I thought it was going to end up in, and how it ended up is still pretty different. So like there's no part of the process where I really knew what I was getting myself into, I guess, if that makes any sense. But I'm so excited for it. Now it really feels good. Like it feels like a book. I think it reads well. I hope people will learn about disability and music, both. Like I kind of saw them as equally important in the memoir. So I want people who love music to feel like they got a really good musical, narration. And then people who care about disability or don't care about it yet and want to learn about it, that they'll get equally fed. So it's kind of a two-part, not two-part, but two streams of consciousness. So it's kind of fun that way too, for me to like get to talk about both,
okay,
instead of just one or the other all the time.
It's such a great title, Galen, and is it a reference to osteogenesis imperfecta?
Yeah, it's got a couple references. One of them is, yeah, it wasn't meant to be perfect. The disability I have is a brittle bones disease, but the official name is osteogenesis imperfecta. But also, the song that it references is from Macbeth, the last album I released. There's a song on there called Perfect, and that's one of the last lines in the song. So, yeah. So it was fun to be able to kind of tie everything, music and disability together, even in the title. Like, the goal is to make it really feel cohesive. And so, yeah, that title was fun. It was going to originally be called Linger in the Sun, but it didn't feel like it fit the, like, arc of the story, even though that is the song that Someday Will Linger in the Sun is the song that I entered into the Tiny Desk, and it really was, it's an important song to me, but the themes of the book are a lot more aligned with this title, so I'm glad we got to switch it about, like, I don't know, 8 months ago, we decided to switch the title.
Yeah.
And I like this one better, yeah.
One of my previous guests is the Irish fiddler Martin Hayes, and he wrote a beautiful memoir, and I remember asking him, like, how he was able to remember so many details, and he said it's like a thread when you start to pull it, sort of, and things come to you. Did you find that?
Yes, that's a really good way to put it. I had that outline, the chapter outline, and it's like about a page per chapter where you kind of say, this is what I'm going to talk about. But then when you actually start writing it, at least what I did is I just let myself write where my brain went. And that's great and terrible at the same time, because the first version of this book was 125,000 words, and the actual book is under 90. So, like, I ended up having to cut almost a third. But the thing that was good about that is I didn't have to censor myself at all. And so if something was coming up that, like, oh, I hadn't thought about it in that way, or I hadn't thought of that thing before, I just gave myself permission to write it, because, yeah, you don't always know what memories are going to come back, or what part of the memories, like, you realize you're writing about this story, but you can't really explain its impact unless you address what happened, 5 years earlier first. And so, like, it's like a thread. That's a good way of putting it, like a sweater or something. Yeah.
So I'm assuming there'll be an audiobook as well.
Yeah. I'm recording it in the end of January, beginning of February.
Okay. That's great.
I'm so nervous. You know, what's going to be fun about that as a musician is there will be music underneath it, like in and out, not like constantly or anything, but it's a totally different. I mean, man, I thought you think you know what you're getting into once again. Like, I hadn't really thought of it, but it's this creative, it's a whole other creative project where it can be different than just, reading it, through. Which is what I thought I'd have to get comfortable, which I will, but then it becomes kind of a work of art, like a podcast, like where you can put sounds in there. So there'll be parts, I think, where even not just recorded music, but like, I think I'm going to probably demonstrate how I loop, like actually audio wise, and then have that underneath. Like, these people who are in charge of the project have done musician memoirs before, and so stuff that I would not have thought on my own at all. So I think it's going to be fun. It's a little bit nerve-wracking because I haven't done an audiobook before, but they said, just try to read it out loud a few times in December and January and, like, get comfortable with it, and it should be fun. So I don't know if it's a new adventure, but I'm glad there's going to be an audiobook, and I'm excited that they are letting me read it because, it's not always the case that the author reads it, but I think it'll feel hopefully more like, you know, tangible that way.
More authentically you.
Yeah, like the stories will feel more real, hopefully. And the music in there is really going to help. I think that's going to be super fun. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be, like, that's the cool thing is there's editors. So I have, like, some say, but I don't have to, like, that would be a lot of pressure, I think, to figure out where exactly to put the perfect thing, but these people have done it before. So I think it's going to be cool.
Yeah.
Group projects, kind of.
Now, you mentioned your Macbeth album. That was such a cool project that you wrote the music for this Broadway production. And I know you got, like, this request and you weren't sure what this was. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah. So as I said, in 2021, I was working on the book proposal and I felt the sense of urgency because, you know, little did I know the pandemic would go on and, you know, continue to be with us in some ways, even now, but like, especially then. I was, you know, I have really small lungs. I'm pretty cautious. You know, even now I'm, you know, not hesitant, but trying to navigate it in a way that feels safe, right? And so, especially in the middle of 2021, I was still pretty much living almost in lockdown, really. But I said to myself, like, well, this is the perfect time to write the memoir. So I was really busy on that, and I didn't want to stop, basically. So when I got this request, I wasn't even really sure if it was actually Broadway, you know? Like, it felt so far out of left field.
Mm-hmm.
But I just, like, couldn't, my brain, like, did not compute, basically. And so I kept questioning and questioning. And finally, the director had to be like, well, Daniel Craig is playing Macbeth. But I didn't know who that was, because I never know who any celebrities are. And so I was like, oh, is he, like, what, has he been in movies or something? And he's like, he was James Bond. And I was like, oh, okay, I should probably, like, this is definitely Broadway then, because, you know, that is, you can't get Daniel Craig off Broadway that easily, I don't think. So then I decided to do it, but it was, again, it was like one of those projects where you don't really know what to expect. It wasn't something I'd done before. So I recorded for three full months, three times a week, like 4 hours a night or whatever, to get all the cues ready, because originally the director had thought about me just doing it in like 10 days in New York, and there is no way. Like, I mean, I knew, luckily I've done enough albums to know that that was like, maybe some people can do that, but I was not going to be able to do it that way. So I said I'd really like to have it done before I get there, and then we can edit it there. And then so that, the editing was a much, much bigger process and real time. I mean, we were like making changes up to the previews, you know, like through previews, basically. And so it doesn't get really finalized till like a couple of days before opening night. So all of that was me working with the sound engineer, Jake Larson, to get it ready. And that was, it was a lot, but it was fun. I mean, in retrospect, it was more fun in retrospect than it was in the moment, maybe. But yeah, and then the it came out, and it was just like really fun to see opening night. My parents flew out, and my in-laws flew out, and like, it was a really special, Michael Sipe was there with me, because I had met him in this whole melange of life. And it's the lead singer of REM, just so, like, that's his, like, thing. So we got connected, kind of back, like, while I was recording Macbeth. He asked if I could sing some harmonies on a track, and so I did. But then we actually got to meet out in New York, which was really fun. It had happened around that time, and so it was just a really special memory that night. And then I went home, and it went on for several months. And I always intended to release it as a soundtrack. You know, this happened in, like, opening night was the end of April in 2022. But, like, the book just, like, really took over my life. And so I finally got a fellowship. That's what sparked it, actually, is I got a fellowship called the Whippoorwill Arts Fellowship. And it's really amazing. And if you know any folk artists, like, I would connect with Whippoorwill. They do a lot of good work outside of this fellowship to support folk music, and specifically, like, that's their passion. And it had to be tied to a project, and I was like, well, I'm writing a book, it has to be tied to a music project. And I was like, I'm not gonna be able to, like, come up with a new album like in this period of time. It was a 18 month period or something. So I was like, what about releasing tracks that I have not yet released, and then touring with it? And they were like, yeah, that would be school, so I mixed it with Jake. He did a lot of the like pre-mixing to get it ready and basic editing, and then we spent like a month like mixing. No, not even a month. I think we did it. We kind of knew. By then I had heard the music a lot. So maybe it was like 3 weeks or something. And we got it mixed and mastered. And then I went to the UK to promote it. I'd love to do that in the US once the album's out. Or once the book is out, I'm going to kind of jointly bring those to various places. Because I never got a chance. Because then it was heavy into editing. So yeah, never got a chance to really promote that Macbeth album, like officially. But it was such a fun, and I love the way, like, it was so fun to make something so atmospheric and weird. I mean, the tracks are, like, 12-minute long, like, instrumental ones. It's a very different album than anything.
Yeah. It is, yeah. So let's talk about Perfect, that last track, the song on the Macbeth album. I was wondering, is this referring to Lady Macbeth? Like, what is this?
Well, in the play, it was. In real life, I mean, I wrote it right before I got asked to do Macbeth, so it was sort of like the stars aligned, like maybe the week before. I mean, it was right around the same time, and it's really about marriage, about like, you know, you kind of have this vision of what it's going to be, and it's not always the way you imagine it, and it doesn't mean that it's bad. It's just, marriage is an interesting, and I mean, any long-term relationship like that is just, your expectations don't always match what you are actually living. And so the song is kind of about marriage, but then it like dawned on me, I was going on a walk shortly after I had accepted the assignment, but like it really felt also like something Lady Macbeth would think in the last moments of her life, right? And so it ended up, yeah, like every lead character had their own musical theme in the soundtrack, and that was hers, and it doesn't come in until the very end. It's like the last cue in the last moment of the play, but in order to kind of seed her in throughout, I took a line from the bridge, the melody, and kind of made cues out of that one line that kind of flows in and out of the play. So I don't know if anyone else will ever notice, but it made me extremely happy to have this like little nerdy Easter egg kind of throughout for her theme, and then the real theme is the song. So it was really fun. That was probably like my favorite part of making that, was finding ways to kind of keep her in the play without giving away the fact that it was the song at the end.
Okay.
I got it wrong. It wasn't meant to be, wasn't meant to be perfect. We were so busy painting, we didn't see the corner. Some days we both felt trapped there, but still the nights were warmer. We navigated love. Terms and conditions applied. Some were pre-existing, others grew over time. Behind the scenes, we just wouldn't let.
So for people who aren't familiar with you, it might be good to talk about how you grew up. I was thinking about your school music teacher, who was so flexible and creative in encouraging you to play violin a little differently, and the fact that you'd done adaptive ballet and kayaking and other things, like you were used to thinking that way.
I had a really wonderful teacher. She was just the public school orchestra teacher, so it wasn't like a adaptive music person, but I, in order to join orchestra, you had to take a music listening test, and I happened that year to be the only one that got a perfect score. And it's not like some great, it wasn't a very hard test in my opinion. It was just like, which note is higher, which note is lower. But I do have a developed ear. My family's really musical. And so I think because of that, and maybe she would have done it for any kid. I hope that's the case. But I know that at least in the, like, we're talking the mid-90s. This was a long time ago. We're way before a lot of the disability representation we're seeing today was really visible. So on her own accord, basically, she was like, I should probably try to help this person figure out how to play if this is what she wants to do. And so we experimented with the cello. That's what I really wanted to do at the beginning. But it just really wasn't working. Like we both came to that conclusion. She didn't say, no, that's not going to work. We tried it and it just wasn't going to work. And so then we eventually figured out that I could play the violin kind of like a cello. So it kind of met the technical requirements and it still kind of felt like I was playing a little cello, which I liked because that's what I had wanted to do. I think on some hands, like I think when you're disabled, especially if it's a physical disability that affects your day-to-day functioning, I think I kind of think in all respects, disability makes adaptation a requirement of living. Like every day you are adapting and it's eventually it just kind of becomes the way you approach everything. So for me, it didn't feel like a big ask to try to learn the violin differently because I reach for my coffee cup differently. Like I have a little reacher stick, like I do everything differently. And so, but the remarkable part is that she was open to that. And I think that's one thing I wish educators knew, and I wrote a lot about this in the book when I talked about it, is like what I wish educators knew. And it's like it shouldn't be a fear of like, oh, they might not go as far, because almost no students end up being professional musicians. I mean, it's such a rare thing anyways, so like just treat them like any other kid and help them figure it out as far as they can go, and maybe they'll quit after a year, or maybe they'll play the rest of their lives. And that's the case with pretty much any kid that you encounter in a music program. It's the same standard, actually. It just doesn't look the same because they're adapting, but the adaptation itself isn't the scary part for the disabled kid. The worst part is feeling like you don't want them there, or I've had another teacher later who is much less cool in that regard. And that's what hurts, is when you know that a teacher kind of wishes that they didn't have to think about it. You know what I mean? And it's, or didn't see you in the same light, or ended up, like kind of not providing, just saying you're on your own. You know what I mean? Like that's actually the damaging stuff. The damaging stuff is not the unknown of like how far maybe we won't figure this out. Eventually, as most people do, like if you really suck at math, eventually you're just like, I don't really want to do math anymore. I mean, some you have to in our school system, so maybe that's a bad example, but you try something, you really aren't getting it. It's a very rare person that's going to keep going forever and ever on it, and then eventually they will get better. I think students, for me, like I didn't insist on playing the cello once it became clear it wasn't going to work. I switched gears into something similar, and I think that that happens naturally. I didn't need the teacher to tell me the cello wasn't going to work. I can figure that out on my own eventually. And I think we all do that naturally. And so some of the fears around disabled students, I think, are unwarranted if you look at it through the lens of the kid trying it out,
And the ancestors of the violin are all played in that way, the ahru,
Yeah,
the
that's the
chime.
interesting part. Yeah,
Yeah, and I've
that's so
had,
cool.
yeah. Like on this series, one of the things I was interested in when I first started it was talking to people in the violin family. So, like Mongolian, what's it called? The Morinkur, their horsehead fiddle, which is maybe the first ancestor of all these instruments. And I've had many different instruments like that. And I'm
So
curious, have you
cool.
tried like the ahru at all, the Chinese violin?
Oh my gosh, it's like a dream. I haven't done it yet. I will someday. Like I love Chinese traditional music. Like I listen to it myself, and that is an instrument that's always been like, ooh, that'd be fun. It's just a matter of I need 5 lifetimes, and I would like them to commence shortly after I pass away, and then I can come back and do another one. Because yeah, it does feel like there's just so many things I want to try, but that is on the bucket list of like getting. I have a 5-string. That was another thing that was on a bucket list because that does have the low C string like the cello, and I have it, and I got to get better at it. It's a little different to play because the angle of the bow is not what you're expecting, and it is a little bit bigger, so it's a little bit harder for me to navigate, but I still am really glad that I finally got one, because I'd always thought, that that would be something I'd like to try. And same for sure with the Erhu.
You could get a smaller one too. someone can
make. Yeah. I kind of was trying to judge like sound quality with, you know, like the big, like what this one is, which I think will work if I just gotta work on it more. Basically, is it's a little bit. It's the same body size as a full size, which I now play. I used to play a 7/8, but I had a friend who was a really great violinist, but decided she didn't want to do it anymore, and she gave me her violin. And at first, I was like, "Oh no, I could never get rid of the." And I played it, and I was like, "Oh, okay, fine. This sounds way. It's such a nice sound. It's big. Mine was a student. Like it was old. It was 100 years old, and it still holds a very special place in my heart. But it didn't have a particularly robust sound, and so this one's cool. So now I play a full size. So it's the same height as a full size, but it's a little wider. And that's how he achieves the resonance. So it's not actually taller, which is good for me. But it's still just a little unwieldy. But I think I will figure it out. But I love the way it sounds. Like it's pretty and rich and a little bit bigger than just putting a C string on my violin, you know.
And I understand at a certain point there was a doctor who suggested that if you had surgery that maybe you'd be able to walk, but you maybe couldn't play because it might affect the nerves in your hands or something.
Yeah, they couldn't guarantee a lot of success. So kind of to speak out like against people doing that, because I think, you know, a lot of people with my disability do choose to have their limbs straightened, and for some of them I think that works. I happened to know a guy in my hometown whose family... And, you know, this was a long time ago. He was older than me by, like, 30 years. His family had him go through a lot of the surgeries, and his legs essentially, like, didn't work anymore. He never walked. And so when they were telling me about the surgeries, I'm a little kid, and, I mean, who wants to have surgery as a little kid anyways, personally? But my parents gave me the choice, which I really appreciate, honestly. And, again, I'm not going to speak out against people who didn't give their kids a choice, because I get it, like the younger you do it, the easier I think it is to adjust, but they didn't feel comfortable with that, so they said, you know, you can decide. And so as a pretty young kid, like 8 or 9, you start talking about it, you hear that once puberty happens, it's a lot harder, so there's sort of a shelf limit of like how long you can make that decision. And yeah, but they would say things like, well, you might be able to walk, you might be able to like even run around, or you can maybe do short distances or at least stand. And then they started getting into some of the side effects or whatever. My arms are so bent, you know, they're like at beyond 90 degree angles, that like they were worried about maybe damaging the nerves when they straightened out my arm, because the nerves grow around your bone, and that's a lot of impact for them. And so and it never sounded like for sure I want to do it. And then after I started playing violin, I basically knew I definitely didn't want to do it, because they, you know, losing feeling in your hands or your feet. I mean, of course, you know, again, everybody's life is different and you can obviously lead a good life that way. But I felt like, why would, you know, it just wasn't important to me anymore to walk. Like the life I had built was really fun, and I didn't feel like that was a risk I needed to take. And again, everybody's got to make that decision for themselves. But I'm glad that I didn't, because I really have obviously been impacted a lot by music. And, I, you know, it's a fun way to go. And I wasn't in any pain. Like, you know, I think sometimes people have to make that decision for themselves, too, based on pain or whatever. But I wasn't. And so I was like, I just don't know if it feels necessary. Yeah. Yeah, so I didn't do the surgeries.
I thought, you know, I wanted to get a little bit into some of your albums. Now, a lot of people have heard Someday We'll Linger in the Sun. That was, you know, I knew your music from that, Gaylin, but it's interesting, when I thought about having you on the podcast, actually, I heard you speaking with Leif Carlstrom, because he was on my podcast.
Oh, yeah, I love that guy.
So sometimes when I do research, I listen to previous interviews people have done to make sure they don't do the same interview with me and learn a bit more. So I thought, who's this interviewer? They're really good. and then I recognized you, and then I remembered seeing the tiny desk thing, like so many millions of people had. So I'm really glad you agreed to this. But that was the connection. Is I heard you as an interviewer, because with him.
Oh, that's awesome. Are you serious?
Yeah,
that's very cool. I loved those. That was the Sunday session shows. Yeah. Yep. I really enjoyed doing those. That's cool. That you found that way.
Now, Now, so maybe we could include, like, you also included that song on your Learning How to Stay album in 2018.
Yeah.
So could we include a clip of that song for people, or?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Okay.
Any version. There's three versions, actually, which is kind of hilarious. But there's a solo version, a duo version, and then the full band version. Whichever one you like.
What's your favorite?
It's kind of a mood thing, which is why I have done it many different ways. So it's whatever you think fits. For audio, I think I like the duo version, maybe, because it's got these pretty xylophone bell thingies. But honestly, it's really up to you. Whichever one you think fits.
Okay. Often for people, getting this tiny desk opportunity really changes their life. And for you, this definitely happened.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Paul before, your husband. So you guys completely changed your lives. Like, you went out on the road.
Yep.
Hi, just a really quick break from the episode. I wanted to let you know about some other episodes. I've linked directly to this one, which I think may interest you. With Jesse Stewart, Renee Yoxon, Mark Groudon, Martin Hayes, and Kelly Toma. In the show notes, you'll also find a link to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get exclusive information about upcoming guests, a link for my Ko-fi page to support this project directly, where you can buy me one coffee or every month, and my podcast merchandise store with a design commissioned from artist Steffi Kelly. You can also review this podcast, share it with your friends, and follow on your podcast app, YouTube, and social media. All this helps spread the word. Thanks. Now, back to my conversation with Gaylin.
Yes. It was a big, huge change. I think we had been married 3 years. We had been together 10 at this point. So we had this whole, life pattern. He was a custodian at UMD, and I taught fiddle lessons, and I had had another, a bunch of other jobs before that, and we were very firmly Duluth, right? But that year, I had just started thinking about, maybe I could try a regional tour in the summer. He doesn't have a lot of time. He didn't have a lot of time off from work, 2 weeks a year or whatever. So it would have been, kind of a big ask, but he was willing to consider it and take that time to go try a tour. And I had just released my first album in November, so 4 months before the Tiny Desk, All the Roads But Lead Us Home. And that's mostly instrumental. There's two vocal tracks. It's totally solo, all live, looped, very stripped down album. But I was kind of developing in my mind as an artist, I guess, more in embodying it, instead of just this is my hobby. It felt a little more central. And then when I won the Tiny Desk, the thing I wasn't expecting, which I guess you just never know what to expect, is that people from all over the country were like, could you come play at our venue? Could you speak on this? Because I was also conveniently, literally, in October, had done my first speaking gig. And then I had started getting asked to do, local nonprofits in the area about accessibility and disability awareness and stuff. And so it was, all kind of coming together at this intersection. So when I won the Tiny Desk, I had already just literally a month earlier put that I do public speaking on my website, and all these things had kind of developed simultaneously. And so it kind of dawned on me, if I was ever gonna try touring, this would be the time to do it. And so Paul and I talked a lot about it. I had some mentors that I kind of like picked their brains, and we decided if we wouldn't go into debt, that that's what we wanted to try to do. So he was very fortunate in that his workplace, the university, gave him a 6-month unpaid leave, so which they totally did not have to do. So it's really cool that they were excited for us, basically, and they wanted us to try it. But they didn't. But they knew, which is true, that if it didn't work, it would have been really sucky to come back to no income, because he was the primary breadwinner at the time. And so, anyway, so they gave him the leave, and we tried it out, and it was just like, it was hard, but it was really, really energizing, and it was working. Like, public speaking, for sure, public speaking helped make that financially feasible. Like, I would not recommend quitting your day job and thinking that you're going to play folk venues and be able to not go into debt, honestly. Like, that is a hard road, but we have this other thing where I could go speak at a conference now and then. And so diversifying is very important, I think, for anyone as an entrepreneur, but especially as an artist, having some other thing that you can do to kind of fill in the gaps, because there were definitely shows where there were like 7 people there and we lost money, basically. So I mean, kind of often, more often than one cares to admit, right? So it's a hard career, but it was really, really fun. And we sold our house so that we wouldn't have to be on the hook if anything went wrong for it. Got an apartment after that a few months later, and then a little studio where I am right now. It's very small, but it's cute, and we really like where it is, and it's close to the lake, Lake Superior. And then got a van and just kind of went in full time so that he could come with me. Otherwise, I would have had to coordinate personal care attendance to travel, and that's not impossible, but it was like, that was very daunting, and I know people who do it, so it's totally is feasible, but also I just didn't really want to be away from him for like weeks at a time. That would have been hard, I think. So
yeah,
that's what we did. Life changed a lot after that, for sure. Kind of more, I mean, I knew it was gonna be like, even when they called and actually told me like, we want to announce you as the winner, it's like, you don't know how, but that is certainly a game changer. Like, it was completely unexpected. Like, when I entered, my video is kind of laughable. There's, like, a glitch when I zoom out from my hand, but, like, it's a crappy phone, terrible video quality. So I just was, like, so far from my mind that I would win. Like, I mean, that was really, really not how I saw that going down after I, uploaded the video. But, it was fun, though. Like, a really cool time, it's really exciting. So yeah
I looked up your video submission. I was curious because I'd heard it was like sort of a last minute decision, and your music is very soulful. I really love your singing as well. We'll get into that, but I think there's something about your how comfortable you are with yourself and your music making that a lot of musicians envy, honestly.
Interesting. Yeah, but that's, you're the first person that has ever said that. That's interesting.
Well, I think that's what strikes me.
I wonder. I think one thing that one gift, I guess, of disability, especially a very, very visible one, like, it cannot mask. Like, some people talk about it's exhausting to mask, and I can't even, I mean, I can imagine, but I can't relate to that, because that is, like, the opposite of how my life has unfolded. So at a certain point, you can continue to be upset by it, or you can just say, I can't possibly use my brain energy on being upset with how people perceive me. And it was around junior high when I kind of finally was like, I don't care enough to care about this, you know? I mean, it's not fun. Like, sometimes little kids will cry when they see you, or people will ask. I mean, things that you, like, I could talk about more, but I don't, because it's obviously, like, if we had more education about disability and, like, more inclusion, that wouldn't happen. It's novelty. That's what it is. And it's usually not malicious. Once in a great while, you run into someone where you're like, are they trying to be a jerk? But, like, honestly, even the weirdest comments usually come out of, like, they don't know what to say and they're trying to connect, or they're trying to assure themselves of something, or, like, it's almost never about me, you know? And so eventually I was like, I want to be happy. I want to be happy. So if I want to be happy, this can't bother me because I can't do both. And so I think that is where if you sense some kind of comfort in my body, I think it's just at some point, here I am. And it's kind of funny because Alan Sparhawk has got this he's the guy that I was learned how to loop from, and he was the lead singer in Low, and he continues to make music. His wife passed, unfortunately, a couple of years ago. They were in the band together, so now he's doing other projects. He was a huge mentor to me, but he's got this super cool persona. He's kind of like a quiet dude, a little edgy, kind of mysterious vibes. And it's hilarious because when we played together, I cannot do that. I cannot be cool. I will not be cool, not on purpose. It just our banter on stage was ridiculous because I would be, and he would be like, oh my God, it was like a comedy act on some levels, the way how different we were. And that's just because I can't at this point really be anything other than I am. And that is a blessing, and sometimes it hurts, I guess. But usually with music, it's been good for me, I think, to be in the moment and not really care. And the times when I do care, it's not like I've never gotten in my own head, because I certainly do, and I think every musician sometimes lets their internal dialogue hijack them when they're playing. Those are the times that I don't have fun. So it's much more fun to just not be too concerned about it, and just working yourself through that. It's like a form of Buddhism, basically, is how it feels when you're doing it.
Actually, so when you met Alan Sparhawk, you were playing with Charlie Parr at the market.
I had played with him one other time at a fundraiser because my friend, one of my bandmate at the time, encouraged me, like, go and ask him if you can jam. And I was like, no, I couldn't do that. But then she's like, no, go do it. So I did, and he let me jam with him. And so the next time I encountered him, I knew he was playing at our farmer's market because I was the coordinator with my best friend, and I had hired him. So I secretly had brought my violin and hid it under a pile of jackets because I didn't want to pressure him to play with me again, because I really wanted to, but I didn't want to be that annoying person that was like, can I play with you? Can I play with you? But he asked me, he's like, hey, you got your fiddle? And I was like, why, yes. I happen to have it here with me. And so we jammed, and I guess Alan was there. I didn't know him. I couldn't have picked him out, but he must have listened for a while because he, a couple weeks later, texted me. He got my number from the sound engineer I had worked with on my album, and and then we started with a live score for a Lon Chaney film, and on Halloween, like a horror film kind of thing, and then we practiced a lot for that, and then we decided let's make a band after that because it was really fun. And then literally the day before our first show as our band, I wrote my first song and I showed it to him, and he's like, that's good, let's do it tomorrow. And it was like very scary, but it was good for me, and that's where the stage banter comes in. I was like, I just wrote a song and I've never done that before, and I hope it doesn't suck. And he's like, oh, that is terrible. You have to introduce that again. So, on stage, this weird dialogue. It's actually on a YouTube video, which makes me very happy because, great. It's, I don't remember what he called it, Your Battle or something. It has a different name now. But it was fun that that moment got captured because that was my very, very first time ever singing anything that I had written to an audience. So, it was quite nerve-wracking.
I saw that video. It was really charming, actually. Because it's.
Yeah, that was our whole band. That's kind of the vibe of our band. That's what we so we played many shows in up until maybe the year after the Tiny Desk, and then I kind of started doing more, and he was very, very busy with Low, so we still are friends and connect occasionally, but we haven't played in a while. But he was such a big part of my journey, like a huge mentor, so I'm glad, I'm really grateful that he reached out, because I don't think I'd be doing any of this stuff if I hadn't met him, actually.
And Charlie Parr, he's a cool guy. I looked him up too after I read about
Oh
that.
yeah, he's an amazing guy. He's Just a really great blues roots, resonator guitar, writes a lot of his own songs, but also knows all the old, 1920s, 30s blues tunes, and he's gotten more vocal in a good way about like mental health stuff in the last few years. But he's just like the nicest guy. He's so nice. So like, and I just love hearing him, and yeah, every time we get a chance to see each other, I just really like that guy. So he's still one of my favorite artists. He was definitely, at the time, my favorite Duluth artist. He doesn't live in Duluth anymore, but he did for many years. And so I would go to all his shows and dance in the front and stuff, and like, but I still, he holds a huge soft spot for me. Oh, someday you should ask him. He's great. Yeah,
Yeah.
I bet he would do it. Yeah.
Okay, maybe connect me. Yeah. No, I have all kinds of musicians following all kinds of paths all over the world. Like it's a very broad thing.
Cool.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about one of my favorite songs of yours. I just want to get the name right. Yeah, from your song The Long Way Around, which is from your album you made in 2020, from your improvs you did over Zoom. And I was curious how the lyrics fit in with, because people were like giving you prompts and then you would make something up, but you have this beautiful poetry.
Oh, well, that song actually, it was performed live on that album, but that is a song I wrote maybe in like the beginning of 2019 or something.
Okay.
So I had already written it and figured out how to loop it live.
Okay.
And so that was not like that wasn't an improv. Everything on the album that is instrumental, which is most of it, is an improvisation that was from a prompt. And so the name of the track is what the improv was. But for The Long Way Around and This Hunger Won't Leave, those were songs I had written not long before and had figured out how to loop. So sorry about the confusion, but I do that song, it holds a place in my heart, because that was a it's like a deceptively simple song, but it has a lot of emotional charge for me, so I really like to sing it. It's a really fun one to do.
It's absolutely one of my favorite love songs of all time. Really great.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and it felt appropriate for that moment because I think when the world was going through so much, I mean, as we are now too, I think it's important, like the immediate moment isn't always the end game, you know what I mean? And so in love or in friendship or in like society, really. So The Long Way Around holds a lot of personal significance for me, that phrase.
This is a clip from The Long Way Around.
When two souls meet and the whole world feels new, shared moments sweet, all colors bright and true, and there is laughter and there are good things. And I'm happy to be in this place with you. And I'm happy to be in this place. It out. You lead it all across the table. What's this about? And you're making me unstable, and I don't wanna go down this road with you. No, I don't want to go down this road. I want to go, but I can't. And I won't all learn to so.
Yeah. And your in terms of your instrumental tracks on the album, I particularly love the Dragons and Fairies one with all the tremolo.
Yeah, that was my favorite, because it was so visual. Like, what I would do during those pieces is just kind of, like, picture stuff in my head while I played, and then I would play it on my violin, and that one really took on its own shape. It is a remix of it, which is really fun. My friend Jeremy and his son Max really enjoyed it, so they added all this instrumentation underneath and, like, asked if they could release it with me, like, as a remix. I wasn't involved in them doing it, but it, and that one's fun too. It's got a little more instruments behind it, but yeah that tune, I don't know, it just kind of came out of this picture in my head of these dragons and fairies. Yeah, I love improvising. I don't do a ton of it at my shows because I also don't want to make people feel like they're at a jam band concert. No offense to people who like those, but that's really not my style. But throwing one in here and there is really fun because it's such... And that album was unique because it was a time where I was like, I don't have that many songs. So to play, like, a concert every week at my... Or even three new songs every week. At a certain point, you're like, well, I gotta have something different to play, so yeah. Improvisations were a really fun way to kind of expand and try stuff that I like to do but don't do very often live.
This excerpt is from Dragons and Fairies. Yeah, I started improvising during the pandemic, and actually some of my earliest improvs literally were on the podcast playing back and forth with some of my guests. It was really
fun.
And since then we've put together a band and I have a couple of albums out, but it's especially for me being like a classical violinist who plays in orchestra where everything has to be extremely precisely, you know, It's just extremely freeing.
Oh, yes. And that's kind of how that was the same path. Like in high school, I was very, 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 very classical. But then I had a crush on a boy who played fiddle. And so he would bring me to these fiddle jams. And then you learn by ear, which, I've always loved harmonies just because that's kind of how I grew up. My family sang a lot. And so I realized you could kind of improvise harmonies to these fiddle tunes. And that was kind of my beginning of my love with improvising. And then when I started joining folk bands, it was always improvised violin parts. And then with a looping pedal, it expands that even farther, what you can do. So if you've never looped, have you looped? I mean, it's a fun thing.
Yeah, a lot of people I've interviewed are really, really good at it. And I think, you know, like you said about playing the arhu, it's just like a whole other thing I'd have to learn and really devote myself to.
Yeah, I mean, it's not easy, but you're not bad at it, even if you're bad at it at first. Like, the truth is, it took me, like, a good 18 months to want to even bring it out and play it places. Like, it's really not the easiest thing to do.
Yeah.
But you don't have to, it's a fun skill set. But I get what you're saying. It's like, do I have space in my brain for another thing at the moment? Maybe not.
I was curious about in terms of the fiddle tunes you've learned over the years, in terms of growing up in Duluth, because I know things can be really regional. And you play some Finnish tunes. Is that part of your heritage, or is it kind of like in the area?
The zeitgeist. The boy I had a crush on, went to this Finnish cooperative campground every summer, and they had a festival called Midsummer right around the solstice, and I would go with him. And so there was traditional Finnish music there. That area, Duluth, is a mix of many Scandinavian things mostly, and then, you know, other stuff, English, Irish, all that stuff is kind of a melange here. But up in the Iron Range, a little farther, Finnish is a more prominent, I'm myself not Finnish, but it's a more prominent, like, ethnic group or whatever. And they, I mean, until recently, some of them would, like, still speak it and stuff. So I loved that song. The first time I heard the accordion player play it, I was just like, oh my gosh, what? And so eventually, not right away, but like a few years later, I taught it to a fiddle student who loved Scandinavian music. She was one of the, like, there's another song on my very first album, Hauling from Eksjörad. I don't even know if I'm saying that right, but she wanted to learn that. So, like, you know, it was kind of fun because my fiddle students would teach stuff. I am Swedish, though, so it was kind of fun to, like, get into the Scandinavian tunes because she was really, that was what she wanted to do every week. And so, because that is technically, theoretically, my musical heritage, even though I grew up learning more, or not grew up, but, like, came into music with more Celtic and traditional American tunes. Yeah, so that is kind of, like, the zeitgeist. And then regionally, we play at our little open session, you know, a more old time is, and then there's some Celtic ones, some Irish ones, but not a ton of Scottish ones. So, like, you know, there kind of is regional. I went to Edinburgh, though, with that Whippoorwill Fellowship, and got to end the week in, or the, well, the month, it was a long tour, it was 10 cities, but end the time we were there in Edinburgh, and I got myself into a jam at the Sandy Bell. It's a little pub in Edinburgh, and the first night, it was very clear, the lady leading, because different people lead every evening, and she was, like, N-O-T into a random tourist, like, sitting in, but then I think as, so I just kind of, like, sat in the corner and played, and, like, she, like, didn't, like, even look at me for a while there. And then eventually, you know, like, she was, you know, admitting the fact that I was going to be there, because I was just like, you know what, I really want to do this. And there was, like, the bartender said, there was no, like, you can go jam, yes, you can do that, right? And so I was there, and then finally, thank goodness, some dude from Chicago was in the bar, and he's like, oh my gosh, you're Galen from the Tiny Desk. And then she had to acknowledge that I existed. And so I played that night, and then I went back the next night to a more open jam, and then I went back two nights later. So I got to the jam in Edinburgh, and it's funny because the first night, and I think it was maybe her deterrent from me playing, she's like, oh, well, that's a American tune, or whatever, you know, like, if I was to, like, ask her what tune she knew. But then the next night, when it was, like, the more open, good-natured vibe jam, and no offense to her, because she ended up being cool, we ended up talking, and I really liked her, but I think in that bar in particular, tourists sometimes just come in and take over, which is not what I was doing, but I can see that there's some hesitation there. And so anyways, the more friendly jam, you know, we know a lot of the same songs because they travel all over the world, you know, they know, like, ones from Canada, and they know ones from America, and I know ones that they know that they learned here, and it's really cool. I didn't expect that, actually. I kind of thought I would go to a jam in Scotland and not know any of the songs because I don't know very many Scottish tunes, and it turns out it's just like this big melting pot of fiddle music, and that's literally how it is. Like, it's because, I mean, Edinburgh jam, that's been going on for 30 years. If anyone was gonna, like, only know Scottish tunes, it would have been them, but they knew all sorts of tunes, because if you love the fiddle, I think you just get drawn to the melodies, and that's what you want to learn, basically. So they didn't know Scandinavian tunes, I will say that. That was out of their repertoire, but all the other ones were kind of up for grabs. Everybody knew a lot of the same tunes, which was so cool. Yeah. It was really fun. That was a highlight of the trip, I must say.
Yeah. A couple years ago, you did a project with storyteller Kevin Kling, Invisible Fences. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. Yeah, that would be awesome. So Kevin is a storyteller who lives in Minneapolis. He was on All Things Considered for a while. He as like a commentator from time to time. And he's gone on to write a lot of plays and some books based on his storytelling. And he's done a lot. He's about 65 or something, so we're not quite the same generation. But he asked if, and you know, we've played a few shows together where, I mean, we just did this at a festival, not the whole play, but we did a thing where, like, he'll tell a story and then I'll play a song that kind of loosely relates to the vibe. So that's what I thought we were getting into when he asked me, will you do this project with me? Because we had already done that a few times and it was always really fun. But it was supposed to be a disability-themed events, right? And so his vision originally was he would look up like stories about disability, and then I would play a song. And the more research he did, all the fables about disability suck. So like they are all terrible. Like the moral of the story is 100% not what modern disability activists or even just humans of any persuasion would want to have told about their life story. And so, and it's funny because sometimes it's hidden, like it seems positive, and then you kind of unpack it and you're like, oh my god, what, this is horrible. So we kind of started feeling like at an impasse, and then we ended up having this really fun conversation where I was like, well, you know, maybe we're starting to talk about maybe we need to write our own thing then, because this is not gonna work. And I was like, well, have you ever like felt, and I was like, and don't take this the wrong way, but like kind of not human, like, because it's true, my husband and I mean I do feel human, by the way, on like a every normal level, but there is this part of me, like this playful part, that I like feel sort of like a woodwind creature that like lives in a hole in a tree and like likes to sleep in late and make music and like I don't know how to explain, like, you know, some people, I know another little person who really loves The Hobbits, and it's not, nobody's telling her to love that. Like, you do feel, especially when you're small like me, there's some part of you that is like, it's fun to imagine being a woodland creature. And I don't know if everybody does this, I can't speak for anyone else, but it was a creature that Paul and I had kind of like already named. It was a Largraf. It was green. It had wings and the snout. And like, we had this whole thing already. And I told him about the Largraf. And he was like, oh, that's hilarious. I kind of know what you mean, but I think I would be a grasshopper. And I was like, why a grasshopper? And he kind of explained that he loves being part of a swarm and like being part of a community, right? Because I'm more of like a solitary creature. And so, anyways, we ended up writing this whole play, like a full play, about these two creatures meeting and becoming friends. I wanted a backstory for the Largraf that didn't set her apart too much, so sort of akin to my story. She's a platypus with a spontaneous genetic mutation, which is what my disability is, that makes her this kind of magical kind of creature, like different than the other platypuses. And she loves music, and it like makes her wings flutter, and that's sort of her backstory. And his backstory is he got separated from his swarm, and to survive he ate all these books in a library and digested them so he can quote like anything, but he doesn't really know what it means because he's not a human. And so it's a hilarious premise, and we go on this big adventure, and it touches on, I mean, he doesn't live, grasshoppers live for like a week once they're a grasshopper. And so it's kind of a touching story, except for also very fantastical, and like, it was so cool. It's gotta be one of my favorite things I've ever done, because, I mean, it really spoke to disability in a way that, like, felt authentic, finally. Like, really, really, like, this is what I want people to, like, walk away thinking about. And then, but also, it was fantastical, so, like, any age enjoyed it. There was a sing-along, like, it was my music. And we put the songs I'd already written, kind of in the musical throughout. It's on YouTube, so like your people can watch it. But it was really fun. We've done it 3 times now, and it sold out like every time, which is pretty cool. And I hope we get to do it again, like 3 different runs. So we've done it 3 times in Minnesota. And we're always hopeful that maybe there's a way we can do it in another town or bring it back or whatever, because it was just, it's very heartwarming. Ironically, the second time we did it was like right after the election, and it was very sad for us. I mean, I know not everybody was sad, but we were, and but it was a healing kind of thing. Like the vibe was, it's because it's a very uplifting play, but not in like an inspiration porn kind of way, but like legitimately feels uplifting. And I gotta say, you know how like when you're on to something artistically, or like when something speaks to people, it's almost always because it's so much bigger than you could have made it yourself. Like there's something about that play that came together in a way that really feels like we're not the main drivers, and so both of us were like, how the heck did this, I mean, it was really fun. So I hope it's not the last time we get to do it, because it was really fun to see the audience connect. And some people with disabled people came pretty much every night, but then it also resonates with like anyone who sees it. So it was really fun. It would be fun to do again.
Yeah.
I know that's a really long answer. Sorry about that. But
I will link that video in the show notes for people. And
thank you.
I know I'm mindful of your time, Galen. So I wanted to get into a little bit more about disability rights activism.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've met a lot of people, and you continue to also even through your Zoom chats. And so I have a few questions. Like, one thing is, because you grew up with this disability, do you think your mindset's a little differently than people who've had accidents or things have happened to them?
Oh, for sure. Yes. Yeah. 100%. Yep. I think it's been good for me to meet people who have experienced different kinds of disabilities than me. I mean, it's been so good. I don't think you can really be an activist ultimately, permanently, without kind of recognizing that your experience is only one of many. I think there's universal truth to disability, like behind the scenes, like we're like, I think disability being like a normal part of life is a message that I really wish was more embraced in our culture. But to say that we experience it the same is totally different. You know, we were talking about, you know, disability pride on a really impactful for me panel. And, you know, and how disability can be like a source of joy, which I do believe. And I think eventually most people get there if they process their disability. But one of the guys on the panel is a disabled artist who was paralyzed from an accident. And he's like, you know, I'm getting there. But like, it wasn't, like, that is not how I felt at the beginning, and sometimes I still don't, you know, because he knows what it's like to have a different body, and I don't, and just kind of, you know, like, I think we all have to travel that road to acceptance, and maybe even celebration at a certain point, on our own timeline, and not be forced to pretend to, like, love stuff, you know. And, the interesting part is, you know, two things, is, like, I have anxiety and PTSD from some medical trauma. I would say in my life, those have been harder for me to deal with. Now, accessibility is hard. So, like, I'm not going to pretend that lack of access isn't frustrating. But, like, in terms of impacting my daily, day-to-day life, I would say anxiety and PTSD have been harder, and depression, like, mental health stuff. And doesn't mean I don't see myself as, like, a full person, but I guess it would be harder for me to be like, and this is where that brought me joy. You know what I mean? Because like, so I don't think it's good to like put toxic positivity or whatever into disability. But I think what it is, and this is kind of how I've always felt, is like, without these experiences, I wouldn't be myself. And I think at the end of the day, I am glad to be myself. And so to wish away part of even the harder stuff is not, I mean, there's like, everything is two sides of a coin. So like, the other thing is, recently I got diagnosed with ADHD, and I will say, as much as I've done a lot of thinking and working about, like, you know, disability culture and disability pride, a lot of the messages you get around organization and stuff are pretty shame-based when it comes to if you have ADHD. So you don't feel great about, like, a lot of the, like, traits or whatever, the, like, the time management, blah, blah, blah. And so even just, like, recognizing your own like limits of like where you might have internalized some ableism, you know, and just kind of recognizing that and trying to root it out and move on to a better place with it is important. Again, like with the two sides of every coin, like sure, if I hadn't been born with a disability, I probably would have been a dancer. I really love dancing. I'm pretty sure that's like I can picture as parallel universe version of me that would have been really into dance. But I also think there's a lot of perspectives I wouldn't have and like that have made my life richer. And even that, even really just that is like to me enough reason to accept my disability. And I think most people who eventually do, like Kevin Kling, ironically, this guy we were talking about from the play, he was born with a limb difference on one side. But then when he was 40, he had a motorcycle accident and lost the use of his other arm. So now he is, you know, navigating life differently than he was used to. And he, I think his journey to disability pride has progressed and continues to progress. That's the other thing. It's like, we're never done. So like, I might think I feel a certain degree of excitement about disability culture now that feels revolutionary to me, but I'm sure that I'm not at the end point of like where I will really embrace it, you know, because I think he's kind of made gradual strides. Like I think writing Invisible Fences was good for him because I'm in a younger generation that has been told many different messages around disability than he was, so we had lots of really big heart-to-hearts about like what we think about our disabilities, and it was good for both of us. I think for me to understand that the older generation isn't coming from it in the same place, because they were always told different messages than I was, and that people who come into disability later in life also are going to have a different experience. So it's been a fun, and I say fun, but I mean like if you go into it with an open mind, like or try to have one on your good days or whatever, it helps, I think, to like ponder the possibility that disability has enriched your life in a way that has been helpful. But again, it's like everybody's got to do that on their own. One thing I do, and I will, because I know I don't want to talk your ear off too much, but like I do read a lot of not just self-help, but like spiritual, like Buddhism, like I'm a little daily devotional, a Hindu guy that I really like. It's hard to find ones that don't have negative messages, so maybe I'll give you the names of them and you can put them in the chat, because these are ones that I found that don't really focus on disability as like bad, because sometimes spiritual stuff goes into that. But I think keeping your mind on the bigger picture helps too, because I think everybody goes through challenges. I mean, everybody does. I mean, there's people that you're like, oh, they had such a charmed life, and then you found out their dad was an alcoholic and like beat him up, and like they just don't talk about it. So like I don't think disability is really any different. I think we're all going through struggles, and one way to keep your spirits up is just to like kind of zoom out into this bigger picture and take in things that are helpful rather than hurtful or like depressing, you know what I mean? So that's a long rant, but I hope that answers your question a little bit.
Well, there's always so much more to talk about, and I hope you can come on again, but thanks so much.
That'd be fun.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you for having me, and this was really fun, so thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahrosemond.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support the series, that would be wonderful. I'm an independent podcaster and I really do need the help of my listeners. Keep in mind, I've also linked directly several episodes you'll find interesting in the show notes of this one. All the links are in the show notes. The podcast theme music was written by Nick Cold. Have a wonderful week.